Welcome to the Kinky Cast, a sexually explicit podcast for adults. You are listening to a weekly publication, produced every Friday morning. This is our weekly exploration in the kinky world of BDSM and alternative relationships. Today, we present episode 336, A Tangential Journey into the Mindfuck. Don't forget to stop by our webpage for information about this show and others. KinkyCast.com. With the coronavirus being active, please practice social distancing. Here's your host, Woody.
Thanks, Max, and welcome to another edition of the Kinky Cast. Online with me from lovely Philadelphia is Why Trust Tom Hanks, or better known as Rory. How are you?
Hey, Woody. Doing all right.
All right. That sounds so good. Other than some technical difficulties this evening, we're doing just fine.
Yeah, running half an hour after the...
You know, what's a half hour?
It was a fun bonding hour of technical difficulties.
Yeah, you know, texting back and forth. We have nothing but fun around here. Rory, you've been on the show once before. Back then, you had a very interesting video about putting hot peppers in funny places and things like that. That was very entertaining video. But that was the other show, and that was back in episode 245, if anybody wants to go back and check that out. But we're here today because you are a practitioner of one of my favorite things, which is the quality mindfuck.
Yeah, a good mindfuck.
Yeah, and you call it a sensual mindfuck. So elaborate a little bit.
Well, I think that sensuality for me was a major part of it. I think that I understood the sensual qualities of sex and desire well before I understood that there was anything mind related going on. I definitely, for a long time, leading up through my early to mid 20s, just didn't know much about sex in general. Like, I hypothetically knew.
Well, you were like every other guy then at that age.
Right. Yeah. But I mean, some of them are ignorant in a very hands-on way. Like, they've done it, but they don't quite know what's been going on. Whereas I, you know, I had diagrams. Like, I probably had some blueprints somewhere. But I wasn't entirely sure, you know, if it would actually work if I put it all together.
So ever so slightly geeky.
Yeah. I mean, geeky is a very nice way of putting it.
Uh-huh. Okay.
So I think for some background, I struggled when I was younger with kind of bridging the gap between, you know, these terrifyingly strong feelings that popped up whenever, you know, somebody smiled at me, and working out how to actually move from that to regular people-being-people interaction. I mean, I didn't really know. I think that it's fair to say that I'm somewhat of an overbearing person in general. That probably gets more intense when I'm flustered and feeling a bunch of things and not sure what I'm feeling and, you know, 11 years old. So a lot of early, you know, sexual experience for me was kind of this mixture of staring creepily and just being completely overwhelmed and just not knowing how to reconcile that with anything else. And so it wasn't really a component of any, I would say, meaningful connections that I had with people. I had friends, I had people who I felt really close with, but because anything that I had going on that was sexual in any way, shape, or form was off in its own weird, bizarre dimension that didn't remotely feel like reality at the time, I think I was just under the impression that what I was feeling was either a crush, like it was this stupid, misleading thing that I couldn't, you know, place any weight in, or it was just this very like guttural, instinctual, biological thing. I was kind of one of those douchey teenagers, I think, who was really into like the worst version of science imaginable, where I didn't know anything about science, but I thought that everything could be explained with, you know, science that I'd seen in like an anime somewhere or like a bad knockoff Star Trek.
That makes perfect sense. Yeah.
So I never went full Vulcan. But I definitely had that attitude of, here's me doing all of these regular person things, then here's this strange biological thing that's going on that's, you know, terrifying and probably great, but who knows what's going on with it. And when I wound up involved in my first sexual relationship, it was very, like, low-key and very comfortable. I don't quite want to say safe, but I think that probably I wouldn't have accidentally stumbled into anything else, because anything more intense than that would have made me run screaming in the opposite direction. And so I had this sense of sex as kind of a warm, intimate thing, like something nice between friends, more or less, but nothing, you know, all that exciting or fiery. And the kind of crossover for me, the turning point, happened when I completely accidentally, whilst trying to find like the most boring straight guy erotica in porn, I sort of stumbled into erotic hypnosis. And it was like, it was a dumb thing. It was just somebody talking over like a striptease video, basically. But there was something about it that really lit me up. And the realization that someone could hypothetically know what was going on inside me and not only just acknowledge it, but play with it and do things with it was just mind-blowing. The thought that kind of it could be not just this kind of like physical thing, not just this emotional thing, but something where there was a real mental connection and sort of an emotional rapport. And then after that, I think just began sort of the terrifying obsession, like the Lovecraftian style madness that brings me here. Hi.
Hey. So when did this all occur to you that there was a sense of unity in the universe?
Well, I mean, unity itself, unity sans sex, was definitely the usual dropping acid, iPhone announcement, all the big moments that make you realize that there's some kind of a harmony to the universe. but sex kind of lagged behind. Like, I managed to get through a number of, you know, personal eye-opening experiences while remaining just completely chaste in all of the, you know, most fun ways. And then I discovered sex, and sex was like this very, it wasn't that. Like, it had these moments of like reading books of poetry on a school bus on a field trip and kind of just suddenly realizing that there was more to the world. And sex for me just wasn't that at first. Like, I had sex the first time and I was like, well, that was very nice. This is a nice person. I guess I can keep doing this nice thing with this nice person and I'll just do that. And then in 70 years, I'll be dead.
Oh my.
But I was in my first all the way sexual relationship when I discovered erotic hypnosis, and I got really excited about it. And I think she was a little unnerved by how suddenly excited I was, because it went from this thing that like we kind of very casually did to like, you know, suddenly I was the sex equivalent of like a guy who just discovered Dungeons and Dragons. Like, I was bringing home big handbooks, like, you know, pouring through all the rules. It's like, you have to check this out. You have to check this out. And it was, I think it was solidly 2 years into our relationship too. So it wasn't like we dated for a little while and then suddenly here's this nice thing. We had our groove, and then all of a sudden I became a sex freak.
A little unnerving.
Yeah. It wasn't what she wanted out of her relationship, I think. And then I spent, I think, a few more years kind of bouncing around being terrified, but like a new kind of terrified, and making, you know, new mistakes. And then gradually found myself writing about it and meeting people who really did want to talk openly about these things and sort of piecing things together bit by bit. Which, I mean, if you could say anything about the kink community, it's that if you go up to someone and say, I had this weird thought about sex, probably someone's, you know, perking right up.
Yeah, their hands go up in the room. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, not even hands. It's literally like Doberman ears rising up. And sometimes they hump your leg.
Yeah, really. So how much of a practitioner of this hypnotism did you get into?
Not much at first. At first, it was just kind of probing it, figuring it out. I found that, by and large, the erotic hypnosis community is much more formally into hypnosis than I am. Like, they get very... The word that comes to mind is there's almost a geometry to what they do. There's architecture to it. There's pattern. There's sequence. It's like its own genre of music, in a sense. And I think that what I found was that I needed something there to feel complete, but that in a lot of ways, what I was looking for was shallow compared to, by and large, how I've seen it explored. Like, I think that, I'm generally hesitant to talk much about hypnosis, not because I don't find it really interesting, but because I know there are people out there who go vastly beyond what I do or what I know about the subject. I think that for me, kind of having the first few glimmers of it was enough. And from there, I kind of pachinkoed all over the place, sort of just picking up things here and there, trying to find ways of piecing it together.
Some people are put off by the idea of sexual hypnosis because they're giving up control, and it terrifies some people.
Yeah. I've done enough exploring now that I understand why some people feel that way. I think it was hard for me to understand at first because I'm very bad at giving up control. Like, I'm very fascinated with my own capacity for bottom and submission, partly because it just does not come naturally to me. It's very difficult. I'm a very picky eater. But generally speaking, if I find myself in a situation like that, to the extent that I lose control, it's very voluntary and willing and kind of moment by moment, and sometimes takes a lot of effort, perversely. But then I think I've met some people who really, you say a couple of words to them and immediately they forget their own name and how to speak. And you know, it's a state of intoxication, and it's a state of intoxication that somebody can slip you into, oftentimes without your expectation, sometimes without your overt consent, in a way where you don't necessarily have the safeguards necessary to pull yourself out of it if it starts happening. And I think there's both kind of just generally that danger of getting into anything when you're intoxicated and you don't quite know what you're feeling or what you want. And then there's the risk, I think, of when we see it played out culturally, you know, any story of hypnosis is non-consensual. It's somebody who is hypnotizing in order to get something out of the person that they're hypnotizing. There aren't a lot of hypnosis stories involving somebody, you know, spending an hour beforehand talking about contracts and setting limits and kind of going into... So yeah, it's there's definitely this sense of unsavory exploitation to it. And when you look at the community behind it, there's definitely a lot of enthusiasm for it that feels an awful lot like it's just flat out rape fantasy. In ways that, you know, sometimes done right in, you know, the right spirit can be well and good, and then sometimes gets a little... You kind of see some things going around and there's a lot of anger behind it, and you go, okay, I don't really know what's going through your head right now, but I hope you're doing all right, buddy.
And that is one of the things that I hear a lot. Each year when I go to Frolicon, they have a hypnosis event, and they'll have a very experienced hypnotist on stage, and he brings 10, 12 people up from the audience, and group hypnotists, you know, gets them all going off into the same direction. And there's a lot of sexual innuendo and all that because it is a sex-positive environment. Mm-hmm. And I don't think I laugh any harder all year than when I go to that event, because it is just delightful what happens up there. And there are some people that are rightfully self-conscious about it. And there are other people that just let it all fly. So and so depending on what your audience is that you're working with, it could go either, you know, I want to give everything I am, or I don't want to give anything I am.
Yeah. Well, I think that in a lot of ways, another thing that for me at least, hypnosis was a huge backdoor into discovering emotional sadomasochism, humiliation, degradation, because really, if hypnosis is working successfully, either you are degraded in the sense that you don't know or don't care what's going on, you're going along with the flow, it's totally fine, and where exactly you are doesn't matter because, again, you're in that flow state, or you're aware enough to be self-conscious about what's happening, in which case you have this, you know, people enjoying themselves at your expense. There's that sense of you not being able to resist it. There's that, oftentimes there's that sense of, you know, that something's going to be said, that you're going to have some kind of a reaction, and you don't know what it is or what you're going to do. And so there's even that dread of anticipating this humiliating thing happening to you. And I think to kind of go back into mindfucks, some amount of what makes for a mindfuck is kind of the mental engagement. It's being perceptive, seeing where somebody's going on. But a huge part of it, I think, and a part that kind of really connects back to the sensuality of it, is just sort of the emotional release. Like, there are so many different ways of playing with emotional states. But if you're going into a mindfuck and you're not feeling some kind of a strong emotion, is it really a mindfuck?
A mindfuck, you typically have to be with somebody that you trust, because they're going to take you down a road that could go in any number of directions. And that's part of the whole thing. You don't know where it's going to go. Mm-hmm. One of the things that I like to do is a sensory overload. And it's where you have something visual, something aural, different feelings going on, electric play, all at once. And the mind has no idea what to do with it, because you can only process so many senses at a time.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
So that's a great thing for me.
I keep thinking that if I were ever to present some kind of a hypnosis panel, I would love to look at the ways that hypnosis connects with some of the more abrasive minimalist composers. Like, I don't know if you're familiar with Philip Glass or his opera Einstein on the Beach, but there are a number of movements in that which consist of something, it's either 4 or 8 vocalists, and every single one of them is just repeating the same jagged 4-note structure over and over again, which is already really harsh, but then different ones are subtly varying it. So one of them will skip a beat, things will go out of phase, and when you listen to it, and that's just sound, no visuals, no touch, but you listen to it, and just for a lot of people, I find your brain just completely switches off. Like, you can't deal with, and again, that's one sense, that's audio being used in a very particular manner. I remember discovering that opera when I was 17 and just being like flabbergasted, because I had this thing that I thought that music was and this thing that I thought the sound was. I'm like, sure, you can dance to it, or like, sure, you can have words going along with it. But hearing this thing that was able to make my brain just completely freak out and shut down was just extraordinary. And I think that there's something just absolutely wild about coming into contact with something that defies your comprehension. Which, to go back to what we talked about last time, one of the reasons I really like hot peppers is that they can have that similar overload effect. Like, I remember getting some powdered Carolina Reaper at some point, just putting a little bit of it into a really mild bowl of chili because I needed just, you know, a little kick. And 15 minutes later, I couldn't feel my skin. Like, I moved past heat. I moved past it just being in my mouth. I hit the point where, like, I could feel drops of sweat running along me, but I couldn't actually feel the skin itself. There was just this fundamental numbness. And it was a psychedelic experience. It was, I found my mind in this place.
You said the word, it's a psychedelic experience. There's whether it's an incredible sensory overload from a chili pepper or a psychedelic drug, you're starting to blur the line there.
Yeah. I think psychedelia winds up in the most fascinating human experiences one way or another. It doesn't always look like psychedelia in the cliched 60s sense, but mind melting experience, no matter what form it takes.
The drug that rather fascinates me, and you really need a practitioner to do it with, is ayahuasca.
Mm.
And that is where you'll have a self-examination. Sounds very interesting.
I've really wanted to try ayahuasca. It's on my short list. I've known people who've had fantastic experiences with it. But that DMT and some of the stronger doses of salvia all just fascinate me. I've done a fair amount of acid and I've done some amount of shrooms, but it's just such a curious realm of experience. I think one of the like very recurring cues that will kind of perk me up if I meet somebody new is if they mention some kind of a psychedelic or hallucinogenic experience. Because one way or another, I think it kind of keeps you from being boring.
It's perspective, a little self-examination.
Yeah. Perspective is the word.
Some people are rather two-dimensional without it.
I went to school with someone who made it a point to try and be more stoned than our professor. And at some point when he realized it was physically impossible, that she would always have smoked more weed than he had, he turned to acid and just showed up in class very stubbornly tripping balls in an attempt to get one over her. It was not the most enlightened use of acid that I've ever seen. But I think it definitely, as somebody who is very scared of drugs of any kind, it went a long way towards making acid seem much less frightening. Like, if this dumbass in my class can do this as kind of a petty grudge, maybe, just maybe, I'm not going to jump off a building if I take this.
Well, and that's it. You know, we have so many stories and myths that go along with it. I had a roommate once that experimented in a lot of chemistry. And I watched him go through some really wild trips. And the way he would relate them, I'm going, huh, how about that?
I always find when I come back from a trip that I'm convinced that whatever it is that I've experienced, whatever I've discovered, is in some way relevant. Like, I don't necessarily know. Sometimes there's a bit of a puzzle to it or an enigma. But I always have this sense that if I can remember what the translation was, remember what in me shifted, I'll be able to figure something out. And for me, that always seems to be true. And I'll pursue it. I'll take notes. I'll write things out. And I do usually come to something. But I think when I come across other people's experiences, it's suddenly much harder for me to have that same faith in what they're going through. I was a tour guide for a friend of mine's first trip. He came over. He wanted acid. I had acid. I gave him some acid. I spent the night with him. And he was, in retrospect, kind of a douchey, creepy guy. But at the time, like, you know, we had a history. And I could see the effect that it was having on him. Like, he was clearly letting go of a lot. It was beautiful to see, really wonderful to see. And then towards the end, he looked at me and just went, "You have the fakest voice." And that, I don't know what he meant. He repeated it multiple times. He was convinced of it. And I kind of had this double response of, on the one hand, bullshit, fuck you, no I don't, my voice is my voice. And on the other hand, it was like, what are the lies I'm telling myself that I don't know that you have seen?
And what does fake haunting voice mean anyway?
I don't know. Yeah. I mean, I had been living with a theater guy for a couple of years, so it could just be that I had some of that going on, but I'm terrified that I'm going to hit middle age and just realize that I've been living a lie this whole time and that he saw, that he knew.
I know something about your future.
Yeah, terrifying. And of all the things to know about somebody's future, like, I'd almost rather he have said, like, you know, 43 is when you're kicking the bucket, you know, fit some living in before then. But like, fake voice is so subtly disconcerting.
Oh, that's crazy. When I've seen people on trips, they focus in on some little bit of minutia that, being that I'm in the audio business for most of my career, this guy, my roommate, was in the audio business also, and he would describe a piece of equipment that we used in the audio chain, and he would say, "What I'm hearing is like turning the gain up all the way on this and then adjusting the thresholds." And he's going into all this really fine detail, like he had crawled inside the device.
Oh, man.
And I'm listening to it going, wow, perspective.
Yeah. I went to an art school, so I had a lot of theater people around. And I remember a friend of mine watching some dumb sitcom with me, and he just started cataloging every single one of the actors, like theater techniques, like the schools they went through. Like when they laughed, he'd point out the method they would have gone through to develop that particular laugh. And for me, as an outsider who just thought, you know, acting was speaking loudly and being a dick, it was wild having him kind of like translate years of academic experience into this moment by moment perception of this thing that, again, I was watching just to laugh my ass off at.
You know, the mind is a incredible thing to waste in this case. You know, we go down these roads that subconsciously we may have thought about it, but to sit and voice something out in such detail, you go, wow, where'd that come from?
Absolutely. Discoveries. It's wonderful to realize the things you'd forgotten knowing. I think a common experience for me with that sort of thing is not discovering something new, but realizing how much I know and put off to the side and just kind of don't think about because I don't think I need to. And then suddenly something happens and I go, well, why don't I take that back out? Why don't I examine that? And I find that there is just drastically more there than I'd remembered being there. Which, to tie back into mindfucks and, you know, to go back to the kink side of things, I think is a very common experience with mindfucks in particular and with kinks in general. There's that sense when somebody taps into a part of you for the first time, when somebody kind of makes you feel something that isn't necessarily, oh, I've discovered this new side of me. It's oftentimes, oh, here's this part of me that I'm always aware of, but just didn't think I had to pay attention to. Here's this part of me that I just kind of assumed was the way that people are, or it was this thing that I wasn't supposed to talk about or wasn't supposed to focus on or wasn't supposed to feel. And suddenly, you know, somebody says the magic words or looks at you the right way and you go, oh, no, this is me. This is who I am. I've been me this whole time. And I was just convinced that this bit of me was some ephemera that no one else could possibly see or care about or value. And I think that core of giving mind fucks, which is a weird way of putting it, the core of mind fucking, is I guess having that love of rooting out those pieces of people, like going looking for the pieces that they're not necessarily paying attention to, the parts that they're hiding but don't necessarily realize they're hiding, and just kind of seeing what they do when you tug on them and yank them out.
People have a tendency to follow an order. Two follows one, three follows two, that sort of thing. And you get somebody into a play situation in a dungeon, and they're expecting it to go one, two, three, and you leave out a number, and all of a sudden, that's when the mindfuck starts. What happened? A friend of mine used to play on the piano, and he would play well-known classical music pieces, and he'd leave off the last note.
Oof.
And I'm going, and I have to go over the piano and hit it. Just, and he loved doing a mind fuck on me that way. And so when I'm in a dungeon play or something like that, and I can get somebody to think that they're going down this particular path and then take a hard left and they keep going straight. And then all of a sudden you're in free fall. That's great fun.
I think, for me, that tendency tends to come out in very perverse ways, in that I like, this is a confession, it's not really a good thing about me, but it's a thing about me. I love ruining the mood. I love when things are feeling very powerful and heightened, just undercutting it, kind of like letting the air out of the room with kind of that like balloon fart sound. And then I think vice versa, I really enjoy seeing the most irritating ways that I can turn somebody on. Like, because there are things that kind of will tap into some kind of a kernel of someone, and every other instinct in them is to kind of like buck and kick and get away or groan and roll their eyes. But if you stay focused and you kind of tease out that one kernel, eventually it can get overwhelming. And I don't know, just there's something really fun about doing a stupid, stupid voice, like a Barney the Dinosaur impression, and getting somebody to feel something sincere and genuine about it. Like finding sincerity where sincerity has no right to exist is really perversely satisfying. And I think on some level beautiful, but like beautiful in the sense where the beauty itself is kind of really annoying and stupid and bad.
Take any good tease and you're trying to say, I can resist this. And they're starting to whittle away at you. And like you say, you know, put in the twisted voice or something like that. I'm going to resist. Then all of a sudden you get, as you say, turned on and you can't stop. You can't, there's no pulling back, and down the rabbit hole you go.
Yeah. The perversity of it is that if you're able to get somebody like that, they kind of use up all their defenses early. And then once they go for it, they go for it. I think a lot about a thing that Brian Eno said, because Brian Eno, in addition to doing just buttloads of music production and songwriting, also just has a side hobby where he's really into perfumes and really into scents and odors, and sometimes seems way more interested in how things smell than how things sound, which is just a charming, delightful thing. And he said at some point that pop songs and perfume both follow the same formula, which is that the nice parts don't matter because you expect things to be nice. The parts of both pop and perfume that get you are the stink. There has to be something so revolting, so repugnant that it kicks in and you just instantly want to like crawl out of your own skin. And yet all of the parts that are nice, the parts of the formula that work, hook into you enough that you kind of can't escape this terrible, terrible stink, this like foul odor, as much as you want to. And I remember reading that and having kind of my opinion on pop songs turned around, because I had like what I think is the very normal instinct early on if a song came on that was annoying, I would hate it and I would hate it and I would hate it. And then 10 years I would admit like, okay, yeah, like I've heard it enough that now I like this. And I think now I've hit the point where if something comes on and it's just absolutely like my instant response is to be infuriated by it, I know that there's something really cool going on there.
And I won't say ABBA or the Spice Girls.
I mean, it's all about telling people what you want, what you really, really want.
It is. Just to play on the word there.
Although I think, and this might be a generational gap, the thought of ABBA being annoying is alien to me, because I just can't think of a time when ABBA wasn't like that gorgeous, wonderful music that I wished modern music sounded like. I just came in late.
It's completely formulaic. You know, it has all the hooks in the right places. It has the beat. It draws you in with the repeated phrases. It's just right out of a playbook.
I mean, I think that in a lot of ways they wrote the playbook, like Well, they're where it came from.
Perhaps. But it also had that little stink in it that held on there, and you're going,
Yeah, I'm going to take back the thing I literally just said. Dancing Queen still to this day infuriates the hell out of me. And it's the opening note. It's that like twangy, soaring opening note followed immediately by the chorus. And I think that if it was one or the other, I could survive it. But the one comes on and I suddenly am dreading the harmonies of that chorus. And then once I get over the first chorus, it's a great, lovely song and I'm into it. And the chorus comes on a second time and I'm here for it. But when it first kicks in, I want to be anywhere else in the world. But at the same time, I have like a near religious love of Barbie Girl, which has got to be more annoying. So on some level, I think it just, you know, pure subjectivity.
And so, you know, we could go through all these different things. And we talk about, you know, the playbook, and different acts have taken the playbooks from previous generations and just rewritten them slightly and put them on. I lived in Europe for a while, and European music is very hook oriented.
Oh, yeah.
And more so than in the U.S. And it comes on the radio and you can't turn it off. It's an addictive thing.
Yeah. I mean, I like not being in Europe because I can take the European pop songs and kind of put them on for the sheer bubblegummy. But yeah, it's, especially when you get, you know, hours of it on end, at some point it just like, it's a madness. It worms its way into you and then it never leaves.
It is. And there was a band in the late 90s called the Venga Boys.
Oh, yes.
Repeated lyrics over and over and over again.
Well, and Six Flags used their one song for their terrible ad. And really, I think that the subtext of the ad was like, this sting of music is going to haunt you for the rest of your life.
And it is a fish hook. They get it in your mouth and you can't get away from it. So advertising 101, you know? Wow. You know, we could psychoanalyze the music industry and movies and acting and play and different things and have a great time doing it. So let's do one last closing on mindfuckery. What is one of your favorite mindfucks that you've done?
Well, I've already hit upon the annoying voice ones. That's like 90%. That's the top. Really get rid of the annoying voice and I'm nobody.
I don't know. You're the philosopher general at some point here.
I think putting aside specific moments, specific things that have happened, I think the things that most stand out to me are the moments where it feels like what I'm doing is just following somebody else's guidebook. And they don't necessarily know that they have that guidebook, but they're responding so vividly that they don't really need to know what they're doing because they're very clearly doing it. And I think of a moment that I had where I really got into dominance and submission more viscerally than I'd felt it before. Like, I understood the basics of the dynamic. I knew how to fit into things, but it still felt a little bit perfunctory. And I found myself in a conversation with a woman who wasn't just curious about her submissive side. There was like a fierce, feral nature to how ravenously she wanted to submit. And it was this almost addictive experience playing with her. It didn't at all feel like, oh, I saw that she liked this thing, so I, you know, ran through the book. It was so electrifying, saying things to her, throwing things out. I remember her being enthusiastic about a lot of different things, but enthusiastic about each one in a very particular way. It wasn't just she was responding the same way to every single thing. It was anything that I threw at her had just this wild ripple effect. And so I found myself just wanting to throw every possible thing, and things got dark and things got brutal and things kind of moved from kind of like seductive to a more savage, ugly, just, I hit a point where I think I just wanted to rip her apart in every possible way. And I think on some levels you could say, you know, I was the one doing things because I was the one speaking. I was the one who had this repertoire to draw from, but it didn't feel like that at all. It felt so much like the opposite. Like, here was this person's potential to be, to be thrilled by things, to lose her mind over things, to go just absolutely apeshit over what got thrown her way. And I couldn't come into contact with that and not immediately do it. I don't know if I was the one driving the car, so to speak.
It was driving you.
Yeah, I might have had my hands on the wheel, but like she was the engine and the guts all the way. And I think that kind of similarly, I really enjoy perversely introducing people I play with to the inverse of whatever dynamic they start with. If I play with somebody who's used to being a dom, I want them to get into their more submissive side of things. I like hurting sadists. I like teaching masochists how to be cruel. Because I think I'm always just very consciously aware of what part's missing in any given moment. So I always want the blend.
And you just, I think you just like mixing it up.
Yeah. Or I'm a dick. I mean, I like to say that I'm, you know, I'm into wholeness, and purity and richness, but you know, two sides to every story. But I think a phenomenon that I find happens over and over again that is just fascinating to me is when I meet people who are very, very hellbent on doing things a particular way, those people are also almost invariably the people who will take to the opposite of wherever they started most intensely. Like, I don't think that I've come across people who took more naturally to dominance than people who like flat out came to me and were just vividly, viscerally, one-mindedly into their own submission. Like they were so desperate, so here for this one thing, so enthusiastic about it. And then as soon as they were presented with like the flip side of that coin, it just, they took to it like they'd known it all along. And something about that, I think, is really fascinating, that when you find yourself in one kind of an extreme, flipping over and kind of finding yourself coming back the other way from just as intense a place, almost feels like a natural progression.
The common thread in this tangential journey down the mindfuck is that it is about expanding one's thoughts and opening the world to different options.
Yes. I mean, I think it taps into the root of what all kink gets at, which is we have these sides of us that we don't know well, that we don't have an outlet for, that we don't know how to articulate, not only because we're uncomfortable with articulating it, but because we've never been told what the words were to begin with. And I think that when I come back to mindfucks, and when I come back to sensual mindfucks, when I come back to mindfucks as they connect to these things that have nothing to do with the mind and are everything about the sensation and the world and kind of just the way that we're intoxicated on things around us simply by being there. I think that at the core of it all is just this awareness of when I'm in the room with somebody else, they are experiencing so much more than they are going to let me see. They are experiencing things more deeply, more vividly. They're noticing details that I would never think to notice. Their imagination is roaming off to places I can't possibly imagine. Like, they're here in the present with me, but at the same time, they are lingering on memories of what just happened. They are dwelling on, like, not even memories of things yet to come. And I think that to be intimate with somebody, to be close with them, to really engage them as they are rather than just as they seem, you kind of have to delve into those folds and figure out what just happened, what's going to happen, and you hit a point where the present moment expands and kind of sinks its roots into sinks its roots back and forth simultaneously, and where what you're doing is kind of taking what under any circumstances would be ephemeral and shallow, and you're kind of making this thing that has gravity to it and that's lasting, and that kind of becomes this space that you and somebody else go for this stretch of time that simultaneously rushes by instantly and feels like shockingly like an eternity.
An endorphin fired mind-expanding drug presented by yourself without the external chemicals.
Yeah. You don't even need to let the dealer in your house.
That's right. You know, so, and you know, we've had sexual experiences that were just make you high as a kite. And it's like the endorphins are firing at a speed that is faster than you can drive the car, you know, as you were saying. And you don't know what the speed limit is. And maybe it's taking the hands off the wheel for a second, just for the thrill of it.
Yeah. And on some level, it's getting over that sense that you're in control, getting over that sense that you know everything you need to know, that you know who you are, that you know what you need to do. I think to kind of tie back in with that that psychedelic hallucinogenic experience, I think we hit moments where what we're experiencing is so overwhelming and vast that we kind of realize that who we normally think we are is just the passenger inside a larger vehicle. And you just kind of have to lean back and trust that your body and that the parts of your mind you don't even think to call your mind already know where to go.
Mind altering. And on that note, I want to thank you for joining me tonight and expanding our horizons.
It's my pleasure.
Thank more than a bit. It was great. Great fun.
You have been listening to episode 336 of the Kinky Cast. For more information about this show, go to kinkycast.com. Views expressed are not representative of the management of the Kinky Cast. We welcome guests with opposing viewpoints. The Kinky Cast is a production of Rooster in the Round. On behalf of all our kinky crew, I'm Max.